think is part of what we are now looking at how to address. So that was another very important part of this liberal world. The other was, in my view, Europe. And I don't want to be too Eurocentric, although those cycles are quite Eurocentric, but it was the creation or the strengthening of Europe. I remember throughout the 90s, what we were saying we were doing is basically the enlargement of the Euro-Atlantic unity. And this was enlargement of the European Union in parallel, by the way, to the enlargement of NATO. And if you look at what happened in this span of how many years, didn't count, but about 25 years of this liberal world, Europe became very different. In before 1989, it was a divided Europe. Part of it was responding to the Soviet Union. Part of it was responding, let's say, to what we call the Western world. We can also have a nice discussion on what the Western world is. And now, all of Europe practically became part of the Western world. Practically all Europe engaged in this year's became members of the European Union. We moved from 12 at the beginning of that period to 28 member states within that period. Then one decided to go elsewhere, but we're still family and we're still united. And actually, I always say 27 now. I have to say 27 now. 27, 37, and 47. We have 27 member states of the European Union. We have 10 candidate countries, and we have 10 more states that belong to the European political community, which is the broader, which is what we call Europe, all of us together, we practically, of course, I left out Belarus, I think, but we constitute Europe. And that's what this liberal order has brought, a unified Europe. Europe has never been as unified as it is now in its whole existence as a historical continent. So I think that's what we owe to the liberal world. Of course, the consolidation of Western Europe. Now, all this was, and there were other advances done during this period. Of course, there were successes within the African continent. In my view, one of the biggest breakthroughs was, of course, the end of apartheid, which and it is partly due also to these changes. The end of apartheid in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, the end of the wars in Angola and Mozambique, the civil wars in Angola and Mozambique. So important developments. We even, at the end of this period, practically, we reached an agreement with Iran on a nuclear deal with Iran in 2015. So a lot of good things happened. A lot of less good things happened as well. So we have a tendency, you see I'm only my first page and I still have six to go. I cut, sorry. So there were other things that happened that were not so brilliant. And there's something that really surprises me that we've all forgotten now, which is no one talks about what at the time was called the War on Terror. Terrorism seems to have disappeared from everybody's radar screen now. I have been to many events, no one is talking about this. Now, okay, so be it. It has not disappeared. It has not disappeared. And when you forget about something, you run the risk of finding it biting you in your behind at some point. But there was a war against terror. There were the wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq. There was this adventure of the Arab Spring with whatever. So I'm not going to go into all these details, but there were also the Western Balkan Wars, which were a very painful moment for Europe. So despite that we were coming together, we were coming together even more after these Western Balkan Wars, we were still looking at some of the aftermath of that. So that was a bit this liberal world, which brought, I think, prosperity to most of the world, which brought an expansion of industrial production mostly to the Asian continent, which brought a very strong and united Europe, and which made, during which the US was practically the the dominant world power, and some even call this period Pax Americana. Don't know how much Pax there was, but very Americana. So that was that. Now, as I said before, when did this period end there? When have we entered this post-liberal world? And in my view, one of the main defining factors, again, is Russia. And it is the invasion of Ukraine. Of course, invasion of Ukraine, and we're going now to commemorate the fourth anniversary since the war started February 2022. But the problems started much earlier. You could trace them back to 2005 if you want, but in reality, 2014, with the annexation of Crimea, was really a tipping point as well. And we sort of stumbled along from 2014 to 2022. Happy to discuss how all that went, but it was really a defining moment in bringing this other period in which we are basically confronted with a conflict that affects the security of all Europe, and I would say all the world. Russia may not be the global power that the Soviet Union was, but it still remains a formidable nuclear power, and it doesn't hesitate to wage that threat occasionally. So that's one of the big concerns. Of course, Ukraine is not the only thing at stake. Other countries in Europe are affected. Other countries also have, let's say, Russian minorities or specificities, be it Georgia with South Ossetia and Abkhazia, be it Moldova with the Transnistria region. So there are different weak points in Europe on which Russia continues to play. And the damage that Russia is doing has expanded to other continents. Russia is active in other places, notably in the Sahel, unsettling security situation, which also has impact for the security of Europe. And of course, there's all the hybrid context of challenges that Russia is bringing to us. So that's a part of the problems that we are confronted with. The other big factor, because there are three, I think, players that bring us into this post-liberal situation. One is Russia, the other would be China. I would not mix them both. I think they're very different issues from a geostrategic situation, and also in terms of how to handle them. So very different situations. And China, in a way, it has not done a single action, if you want, that has, like Russia, that makes us fear China or makes us concerned about China. But it has done a few actions that are very relevant, I think, for where China is going. One of them is when President Xi decided that he would remove the limits to the renewal of mandates at the head of the country. Deng Xiaoping had established this practice of two terms, and then a new leadership would come in. This ended with President Xi, and I think that was an important signal that he gave. And then also, I think the Hong Kong repression was also a very important sign of where China was going. On top of that, if we look at what China has been in its activities in the South China Sea, which are a concern for the region, and how Taiwan could be handled, which is again another concern. All this, of course, within the respect of the One China policy, but nevertheless, Taiwan continues to be a point of concern. And so during these years, China has increased immensely its military strength and its capacity to mobilize forces. It has increased hybrid activities in a number of countries. It has created, and maybe that is oversight on our side, a strong dependencies that it can weaponize eventually, that could be weaponized. And we are also concerned about the support that Russia may be given, that China may be given to Russia in terms of the war in Ukraine, despite the fact that China insists that it wants to find a negotiated solution. But China, again, has changed. And this has led most of us in the Western world, definitely in Europe, and I think the EU was the first to come up with this triptych. I'm very proud of this. of how to handle China. And the European Union was the first to put that we have to handle China definitely as a partner. China has done also good things and has taken millions of people out of misery, and it is an industrial and an intellectual power that we need to reckon and to understand and to work with. So it is a partner, but it is also a competitor, and it is also it could be a rival. And so this triptych, I think, is what all both us, but also the UK, has taken as the main lines to guide our action vis-à-vis China. So that's the other change for the international community. And the last one, I would say, a U.S. shift. United States will continue to be a main partner and ally for Europe, and we want it that way. It's clear. It's part of our community of nations, culture, civilization. But it is operating a shift that started even before Trump to a certain extent, saying that Europe was not its main area of priority, but that has been accentuated in many different ways through the various President Trump's administrations and definitely the present one, which conveys a message that very clearly, and which is a welcome message, that the Europeans have to do more to deal with their own security and have to be more autonomous. And that is a fair point, and actually that is where we're engaged. But then, of course, there are also other statements that are made at times, and including in their national security strategy, that cast some doubts regarding the engagement of the US with Europeans, despite the fact that in his Munich speech, Secretary of State Rubio sent positive messages in terms of the importance of Europe for the United States. But there are some doubts on that field and on the way some things are being operated that require that Europeans are more engaged in their own security. We see this definitely in negotiations on Ukraine, where I think Europeans have been very helpful in ensuring that the proposals that are on the table and that are being negotiated do integrate concerns that are European concerns. Because at the end, what's at stake is the security of our continent. And therefore, the security of our continent, as leaders in Europe say, cannot be negotiated without us, without the continent, and with our views. And this is where we try to advance. So, I'm finishing now. Where are we now? Where are we now? I think definitely we're a world where power politics have gained a lot of a strong foothold, but where multilateralism is definitely not gone, because out of the 194 countries, I think there are 194, maybe some more since I checked last, members of the United Nations, practically all of them want a strong multilateral system. Multilateral system is not over, and I think it has been affected by what is happening. Some of the institutions of the multilateral system are not as effective as we would want them to be, but there's a strong call from the international community to keep a strong multilateral system, and I think that's still the case, and I think it's still valid. Despite the fact that this post-liberal world, some people refer to it as the age of the strong man, or some talk about multipolarity, I would talk about apolarity. I think the poles have gone in a way. But you could argue it many different ways, but I do think that there's still a strong need for multilateralism. And I think this is one of the tasks, actually, that Europeans have together with other partners. So what is it that we need to do now? And when I say that, I think we are in a privileged situation and rather an optimistic situation, because European leaders know what the situation is. They have a clear analysis. They have identified what needs to be done. And so now and we can do what needs to be done. So we have there three very important elements. So now we have to do what needs to be done, which is not that easy nor evident, but we have done it. And one of the things within the European Union is strengthening the European Union itself. And we have to strengthen our economic resilience and security, and there are different initiatives within the European Union aimed at achieving this. We have to strengthen our defense, And we have launched already a number of initiatives within the European Union to strengthen that defense, including a $150 billion loan guaranteed by the EU budget, measures to facilitate, to free up to a total of 800 billion euros in member states to invest in defense. We have also now adopted a Ukraine loan facility, which will finance military equipment for Ukraine up to 60 billion. So all those are important measures that the Europeans have taken, because we have to understand that this goes beyond supporting Ukraine, but supporting Ukraine is essential. We need Ukraine to come to a ceasefire under conditions that, of course, will be fully beneficial to Ukraine, but that will also guarantee the security for the rest of Europe. And this is what is being discussed, and of course, with important contributions, definitely by the United Kingdom, not only the support it provides to Ukraine, but also in the Coalition of the Willing and other initiatives. So we need to strengthen, I said, the economic resilience, defense, supporting Ukraine, proceeding with enlargement. We have 10 countries at the door of the European Union. We have to start bringing them in. It will be perhaps enlargement, which will be different, and the way they will enter may be different in order to accelerate things from what has been done in the past, but they have to be brought in, and that's also on being discussed by leaders in the European Union. And finally, it is about also engaging with our partners in the broader Europe, working with them. So all these efforts that we do in terms of our economic resilience, defense, have to bring our partners on board. And amongst those partners, of course, the United Kingdom, as the President of the Commission was saying in Munich, is one of the key partners for the European Union. And finally, we have to engage with other middle ground countries, other middle powers, sorry, to work with them to rebuild that multilateral world. So those are our main tasks. While doing all this, of course, we need to keep our strong relationship with the United States, and we have to as well ensure that the alliance, which the Atlantic Alliance, which remains a pillar of European security, continues also to advance. So these are some of the elements of where I think we are and what I think we're doing as the European Union and together with other partner countries, particularly in Europe. And I have to say that in this context, a stronger EU-UK relation is vital. We have been advancing in this direction over the last couple of years, particularly with a very important summit last year. We will have another summit hopefully before the summer. We have different negotiating strands with agreements that hopefully will be almost finalized by then. And we will have to continue strengthening this relationship, because Europe has to save itself together. We have to come together as a strong political and economic actor. Even if some of the countries would be outside the European Union, we can still build really a very strong core within Europe, and a core within Europe that will hopefully help bring more peace throughout the world and also bring back a strong multilateralism. So that's, I think, where we are, and very happy to engage in discussion with all of you. Many thanks for having me, and many thanks for coming this evening to this lecture. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. To-do list, I think. Over to you, Federica.
Thank you. As I see the role of the discussant, it is a bit to play the devil's advocate, so you will forgive me for pushing you a bit, because I have two points. The first one is, you know, you have been mentioning the international situation, international context, and geopolitical tensions, and Russia, China, and the recent changes in the United States stance. I'm very happy about it, because being based in the Department of International Relations, I mean, that validates our approach. At the same time, I kind of wonder, what is the role of nationalism more generally? Because, you know, I struggle to reconcile a sort of a purely international version of what is going on, without taking into account what is happening inside Europe as well. And therefore, the fact that there is a return of nationalism throughout the globe, which, in my view, you know, puts at least complements what you said so far. And I wonder, you know, which of the two is most corrosive for Europe, the return of nationalism or geopolitical tensions? Because it seems that nationalism is going in a direction that, especially for the EU, is particularly difficult to handle. My second point is about the role of institutions. As you said, you know, we could have looked at the previous word as a rule-based order. Now we are left with institutions, but at the same time, we see every single day in formal gatherings, E3, E5, E7, you know, but two-speed Europe, coalition of the willing. How do you read this sort of very fluid, informal situation? What is the role of the EU in all this? Is it something that, you know, is able to reformulate itself and be flexible enough to respond to the political situation, or it's losing a bit the sort of the momentum, the agenda, the drive, and the political relevance in today's world?
Thank you.
Shall we move on to Spiros?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, thank you very much. Like Federica, I find the role of the discussant one in which you take on the role of the bad guy simply to provoke the good guy into speaking. So I have three areas I'd like to touch on, and they're probably linked to questions, so I might as well ask my questions at the same time and see if I can provoke a response. The first is to do with this, you know, engaging with this idea of we're in a post-liberal international order. To assume that assumes that before there was a liberal international order, which we discussed. But for me, the interesting thing is that you skirted around and circled around this idea of the West, whether it was the West in terms of a bipolar world, or the West in terms of the liberal international order, or the West in terms of the Euro-Atlantic Alliance. In light of a lot of the other things that you've been discussing, the rift with the Americans, the rise of other challenges from elsewhere, what is left of the West? What is left of the West in terms of interests, in terms of values? Can we speak about we in that way that has some kind of meaning? Or is it just a term we use because we've got nothing else left to discuss? That's my first point, my first question. The second one is linked to this, and I think Federica raised this in a slightly different way when she mentioned nationalism. One of the remarks you made, which stuck in my mind, referred to unity within the EU. And I think a lot of our students and members of this audience would think that maybe unity in the EU is not as strong as we suggest, and that there are certain states in the EU that are not Western, in the sense of, you know, believing in the values and standards and norms of behavior that somehow defined the European Union, the West. So could you say a bit more about this unity? I suppose that your role is such that you have to admit that unity is the benchmark, but can we just have a bit more on that? And the third is to do with defense, and very specifically I know that you are a person who believes very strongly in bettering the relationship between the EU and the UK. And in the area of defense and security, we know that not just this particular British government, but the previous one as well, was very keen to promote security and defense cooperation as quickly as possible post-Brexit. What can you tell us about how this cooperation could come about in real terms to overcome obstacles such as rule-taking, which is something that the British always object to when they talk about moving closer to the European Union in terms of security and cooperation? Can you tell us about how certain European states react to the possibility of the UK becoming involved more directly in cooperation on security matters and not wanting this disruptor in their midst as it was seen in the past? So yes, you know, defense and security in the current context is very important. There's a long history of it in terms of the European Union. Can you place the UK and the EU in that kind of context and tell us a bit more about the process and how we can overcome problems?
Wow, okay. That's a lot and very complex. I would need another hour for that.
I was going to add stuff, but I'll do that during the questions.
You want to ask something?
No. I'll ask during the questions.
Okay, role of nationalism. And this goes a bit together with the unity of, I think. And the beauty about the European Union is that it integrates nationalism and respects nationalisms. This is not a supranational power that just takes over, nor the identity of countries, nor the decision power of countries, which remains intact within the Council. So I believe that the European Union integrates those nationalisms in it, the way it operates, and respect for the specificities of each country. Of course, we have to find what are the areas where we can advance and work in common. That is the main goal. And most of the time, I would say, on most of the issues, we find ways of advancing. It may be sometimes difficult, and then since everything, we live in a very open society, and definitely the European Union is a very open organization. Whatever is said in the smallest of groups will pop up, normally politico, but there can also be in other media, of course, that are equally accurate, and so everything is played up immediately, and so, which is fine, and the differences are played up as well, more than the agreements sometimes. So I think the overall media noise will pick up quicker difficulties than agreements, and the difficulties remain in the in the mind of everybody, whereas the agreements and successes sometimes are forgotten or are left aside. So I think there's that. Having said this, I do not want to just sweep under the carpet the fact that not everybody agrees with everything and there are difficulties. But I would say that in the last years, and one of the biggest challenges that we've been facing is precisely supporting Ukraine. And we've remained steadfast as a union supporting Ukraine with 20 packages of sanctions, with different agreements to provide loan facilities to Ukraine, with a total of 193 billion euros provided in support of Ukraine, out of which around 70 billion have been military assistance. So yes, there are difficulties. I won't say everything is hunky-dory and beautiful. And there are challenges and difficulties, but on the essential, we continue moving forward, and I think this goes beyond definitely nationalisms, and the European Union has no aspiration to restrain or curtail nationalisms. All member states are there's a very healthy way of being nationalist. There may be others less healthy, but there's also a healthy way, which is the respect of the individuality of each nation and its voice and weight in the decision taking within the European Union, and that the European Union respects. Let's see if I read my own writing.
Institutions.
Start more. Pros. Oh, for European. Oh my God. It was a bit of a question of nationalism. A second question there of whether what it was more corrosive, internal or the challenges outside. We are always, I've been working 20 something years for the European Union. I do realize that much of our efforts is to reach agreements within the European Union, and a lot of energy is consumed by that. But I wouldn't call it, corrosive. I would just say that it is amazing to bring 27 countries so far in the way of determining common policies in such complex issues, ranging from economic and finance to agriculture to migration to defense or security. I mean, it is a prodigious task, and no one has done it as extensively and as thoroughly. So yes, it consumes energy, it is difficult, it is played up, differences are played up, and there are differences and there are difficulties. I'm not saying there aren't, but at the end, we find most of the time solutions. My main concern is that we need to find those solutions at the right time, and time is pressing. And there, that's where I think leaders, of course, have to assume their responsibilities and provide the leadership that is necessary. And I think that is what is being done under the guidance of the President of the European Council and the President of the Commission, together with the presidency of the rotating presidency of the Council and other states that are pushing for this. How do you... the different geometrical and can we advance? And this is an old story. Whether for some projects should some member states advance? You take the euro, for example. It was some member states, and now it's practically all member states that are there. You take Schengen. It has been also a smaller group of member states that has afterwards enlarged. So it is true that we have in the past gone through phases where we've advanced with a few member states. Normally it was more than a majority, so it was already a strong majority of member states, but with some having withheld, there's the possibility of abstention for some policies. Denmark had been abstaining and remaining outside the defense policy elements of the common security and defense policy, and now it's rejoined. So that is something that has always happened. It's a model that works. It's a model that can continue working. Now, are there little groups that are running around on their own and leaving the rest of the machine behind? I think the rest of the machine is what makes the Europeans powerful as such. And it's true that for the things like the Coalition of the Willing that is now being worked out to support Ukraine, you don't necessarily think that the EU would be the best vehicle. It could do it, but it's not the vehicle that has been chosen, and it's fine to have another vehicle to which the EU would be able to contribute, because we have actually different military assets and that can be brought to that joint effort. But we have no problem in joining other groups of countries in other formats, also with an EU contribution to make things advance. So I think the flexibility in addressing problems is essential at the end, and we have to give all this priority to what will become more effective at a given moment to produce the result that we need. If at this end, for some issues, we really need the institutional contribution and the institutional framework to do it, then obviously there are some issues that have to be done within that framework. We're not going to be reinventing the wheel at each time, and we should definitely not do things that are going to weaken a framework that has been very costly and difficult to build. So that would be, I think, the red line for these kind of operations. But otherwise, definitely flexibility in the approach. What is left of the West? Okay, this is what is the West, of course. And then there are many books now going on, and you're an expert on this issue. I think that's a question you should reply, yeah, and not me. I'm a poor, I'm a poor practitioner. You're throwing that on nice my try. Lap. It's not fair. Not fair. So I think you have to give us a reply nice on this one. You have to give us a reply. I think we have. There may be many definitions, but there's no standard agreed definition by everybody. I also have the feeling, me personally, as a practitioner, that the sense of the West has widened. So there's more West now than there was before. We have more West even in the East than we had in the past. So the West has expanded to the East. We have a broader concept of what is this. At the end, we are basically linked by common values, I think, which is very important, and common interests. And the West is certainly Europe, it's certainly the United States, it's certainly Canada, it's more countries than that. We have countries on the Asia-Pacific that are definitely part. I don't want to name, because this moment you start naming, then someone will say, oh, you didn't name this or that, so I'll stop naming anyone. But it is a concept that is still valid. What I do think is that we have to think beyond the West when we engage with other members of the international community. I think the engagement as called for by the Prime Minister of Canada, Carney, with middle powers is of key importance. And we cannot make this West against the rest or against anyone. We have to do the West with the rest. And I think that's the game that we have to play now, and we have to play it with other key players, which some of them would consider themselves as well part of the West, and probably they are. So we have to have a very generous and open concept, I think, of the West. But what we need above all is to enlarge our engagement, and enlarge it, as Carney was saying, also for some issues we may engage more with some countries, with other for other issues with others. But we have to engage in order to address immediate concerns, but also in order to rebuild a more effective multilateral system. And I think that's one of the big tasks that we have ahead of us. Unity, I think I've referred to the unity of the EU. On defense cooperation, that was a very concrete question. On defense. And of course, I do remember my times at the early 2000s in trying to build all these structures of CSDP. And our friends in the UK were tough negotiators on these issues. Their main concern was a very legitimate one, that the European Union should not do things on defense that would undermine NATO. And I think that's a concern that we all share, and that no one that has been working or and helping develop security and defense policy of the European Union has ever tried to do anything that would undermine NATO. So that's very clear, which doesn't mean that we, and even now, that we don't have to build a greater capacities within the European Union, greater capacities that could even constitute a pillar, a European pillar within NATO. And I think that's more where we currently are. And in cooperation, practical cooperation with the EU, we've launched a number of initiatives recently. And we've invited the UK to join those initiatives. And this is even valid for these famous SAFE facility. There has not been an agreement on how to provide more space or for more local content for the UK until now. But the facility as such, as it was launched, provides, you know, for at least 35% capacity that could be a UK capacity in the development of defence capabilities, free of charge, plus the companies that would be in Europe, plus the possibility to join in joint procurement projects the rest of member states. So that, even if it's not under what the UK would have thought were ideal conditions, but that instrument has been open to the UK. We've now developed a new instrument for to support Ukraine, which is the loan facility of 90 billion, 60 billion of which will go into defense. And we've opened also the possibility for the for UK companies to be able to participate in procurement for those goods. An agreement will have to be reached, but I think there we've established very sensible conditions, and I'm sure that we will reach an agreement. So when we look at the security of Europe, at the defense of Europe, we cannot see it without a strong relationship with the UK and without a strong participation of the UK. We're in the same boat, and we will continue working with the UK on these issues very actively. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. All right. We've got about half an hour for questions from the audience. I'm going to take questions in a group of three at a time. Please wait until I have signaled you and that you have a microphone in front of you. Please give us your name and your affiliation, and please don't give us a lecture. We've just heard some. Just ask a question. And I will interrupt you if you're going on and on and on. So I'm not afraid to do that. So we've got a lot of people in the audience, so groups of three, keep your questions short and wait till you have a microphone in front of you. There's somebody here with the turtleneck right in the middle.
Hi, thank you so much for the talk. I'm Kiana, I'm a second year international relations and politics student. I came from Iran a year and a half ago. I wanted to ask, I think one of the questions that were missing was about immigration policy of the European in particular. I mean, I've been here for a year and a half, and I find that, based on my lived experience, a very worrying concept, which back then I didn't know about this issue. I want to say something controversial, is that I'm a Muslim myself, okay? But I've seen, I'm seeing a lot of people that are in contradictory with the Western civilization, with United Kingdom, with United States, and everything the West stands for.
Question,
so what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, thank you. All right, at the back, and in the rugby shirt, approximately a rugby shirt.
Thank you for the talk. My name is Adrian. I'm at the Department of Economics. My question to you is, as a diplomat, what lessons can you draw in dealing with actors that neither share your values nor your interests? Thank you.
That's a good one. That's a very good one. Anyway, but the gentleman with the blue shirt right in front of him. Yeah.
Hi, Phil Abner, I'm with the Chartered Institute of Export and International Trade. You've got the Made in the EU policy coming to, well, Act coming into effect soon, or at least proposed.
Can you shout?
Sorry, can you hear me?
Can you shout? Thank you.
You've got the Made in the EU industrial policy coming into effect soon. That's obviously going to change the EU supply chains and move things back towards a more Made in Europe model. How do you anticipate this impacting both European markets as well as relationships with external partners?
Great, so you got immigration. How do you engage in diplomacy with actors that might not share your same values and interests? And then what trade?
Okay. No, on migration policy, but I didn't get very well your question. I think you were saying why are people that have interests or beliefs that are contrary to the West are allowed in?
I mean, extremism will come from Europe much sooner than you expect because of the indecisiveness on the immigration policy.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I you know, the radicalization is a complex phenomenon that you don't need migration for that. We have enough within our current population that can be radicalized in very different ways, and it happens. And we've seen that some of the attacks are committed not by people coming necessarily from outside, but people that were born in our countries. And raised here, so I don't think the migration angle is the main the point of complexity. I think the security forces have developed in the last years very sophisticated methods of following radicalization. The problem is, of course, that we are facing more and more the issue of the lone actor instead of an organized terrorist group. Someone that just spontaneously decides and finds some support through the web or whatever. But these are things that have to be dealt with through security and police, and there will always be a risk. You cannot have a 100% system that will prevent particularly these lone actors. But I think that police forces, security forces and intelligence in Europe has made, and in the rest of the world, have made huge strides in the last years to address some of these issues, but of course it will always be a problem. I would not link it directly to migration policy. I think it brings other questions into play that may provide links that are not necessarily nor true nor helpful. But this is a personal view, not an official view of the European Union. On dealing with actors that don't share values and interests. You deal constantly with actors with whom you do not necessarily share values, but you have to find some kind of common interest. Otherwise, why are you engaging? And at some point, if you dig enough, you do find that there is, what did they say when I was in school studying maths? Le plus petit commun dénominateur, no? The
most common denominator.
The smallest, no? And you end up finding that PPSM, or je ne sais pas, PP, je me souviens plus, I can't remember how it was called. But yeah, you dig enough and you're going to find, because otherwise, why are you seeing that person? When you see a person and when you meet an interlocutor, first thing you have to do as a diplomat is, why am I meeting this person? what do I want out of this meeting? And that will already provide you with an answer. Do I just want to signal something? Sometimes you may just want to signal something by meeting someone, even if you're not going to get anything concrete out of the meeting. In any case, every meeting is not just a result per meeting. Results and negotiations are usually the outcome of many, many different meetings and engagements. So, but definitely, if you engage with anyone, you have to have a clear idea of why are you doing it and what is it that you want to achieve, and whether that person at some point can give you part of what you want or not, and engage accordingly. On Made in EU, this is a discussion that is ongoing within the European Union, so I think it's very difficult to prejudge anything. I think the European Union is very conscious of its own interest and its own interest in keeping a strong relationship with cherished partners whom it needs also, so we don't live in an isolated world, and we're not going to turn into isolationist economic policy and a protectionist policy. But we do have to, and this is the goal of this regulation, we do need to ensure that in certain critical areas we have the industrial capacity that we need to be resilient. And I think this is what this is about becoming resilient. Yes, there can be consequences, and these consequences have to be looked at and have to be discussed. And I'm sure that in the course of the next days and weeks, we'll have greater clarity. But I think the president herself was saying in Munich that she would be engaging also with key and trusted partners, and the UK is definitely a key partner for the European Union. Thank you.
All right, great. Next round. Two straight here on the second row. We'll start there, and then please pass it down after you've asked your question.
Thank you. My name is Alexander. I'm a student here across the road in King's College London. Question to you, a competitor, yeah. My question to you is about leadership in the EU. So as Henry Kissinger famously said, who do I call when I want to speak to Europe? And indeed, we could see some tensions, or some say even competition, between the President of Commission, President of the Council. So if Europe wants to achieve the strategic autonomy that people are talking about, what is your position, what is your view on the possibility of getting some kind of European leader? And do you think states within Europe would support further centralization? Thank you.
Great. Just two down. Yeah.
Hi, thank you very much for the talk. My name's Sophie Church, I'm from the Daily Mail. Excuse me. What impact do you think a reform government could make on the relationship between the EU and the UK? And is that something that you welcome after Labour have tried so hard to repair that relationship post-Brexit?
What's the second part of the question?
Reform government.
Yeah.
Is that something that you'd welcome, a reform government, given that Labour has tried so hard to repair any relationship between the UK and the EU post-Brexit?
Right, there was one at the... I saw a blue shirt in there. Yeah, right at the back.
Hi, my name is Sophia, and I was a student here. You spoke of the plan to try and strengthen the EU for the future, and I was wondering how you saw that objective perhaps challenged by the risk of the ascension of so many new members, and how with already the existing divisions within the EU and the potential for future ones, how this aim of enlargement strengthening could actually lead to more disunity. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for those questions. Leadership and whom to call. I think it's very clear whom to call right now, and I don't see major problems. We have very capable leaders. They all have phones, and most leaders around the world have their phone numbers and call them, and they have clear responsibilities, and they are known as well, and they work and cooperate very well amongst themselves. I think the cooperation between President Costa and President von der Leyen is excellent. They work very well together and coordinate. And both of them are providing, I believe, a very important leadership to the EU in this moment. If you have a Minister of Foreign Affairs, he only has one phone number to ring, which is the phone number of the High Representative, also Vice President of the Commission, Kallas, also has a phone. They have very good phones in Estonia as well, for where she comes from. So she is... So she's also there and is an active, engaging actively with leaders and foreign ministers across the world. So I don't see that as a problem right now. And I think that the system is providing results and is working. So that's what I can say there on the. A reform government, it's not for me to judge on what's going to happen in this country. What I can tell you is that the European Union would work with whomever is elected as head of government, prime minister in this country, and with whatever government citizens of the UK decide to elect. And that we will try as to have the best possible relationship with the EU, with the UK. We're engaged in a strong relationship with the UK. We hope we will be able to continue this relationship, whomever is in power, because we believe that it is in the interest and benefit of the UK and the European Union to have that strong relation, to build a stronger Europe, which I believe is what the and we believe is what the geostrategic the situation now requires. So we will be working with whomever is elected by the people. We respect those choices and are happy to work with whomever is elected.
Widening and deepening.
The accession. And enlargement. It is always a challenge, of course. The more people around the table, it just adds to the voices around the table and the variety of opinions. But I think we have shown that despite moving from, 6 to up to 27 right now, we have maintained the European Union has become more and more ambitious as a project. With its different policies across all areas and as a political project itself. So I don't dare venture what may happen, but if I look at the past, what I can say is that the accession has not slowed down a stronger European integration in the European Union. We've been confronted with crises. From the most recently, well, we had the financial crisis in 2008, we've had the COVID crisis, we have the challenges from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. All these crises have pushed us towards a stronger policies and common policies within the European Union, and this has happened with an increased number of member states. So I trust that an increased number of member states will make our voice even more powerful, will bring also other other values to the European Union, will bring us as a strong entity that will create this basis upon which the rest of European nations that are not part of the European Union can also rely in order to build that stronger Europe that I hope will bring also a better world, a more peaceful world, a fairer world.
Great, thank you. I have seen several of my students in the audience, and not one of you yet has put up your hand. So not to put any pressure on anyone, they're all over the place. Like,
you talk too many things. They don't need to ask me anything.
They know everything.
It was also clear.
Absolutely, right at the front here, right in the middle, fourth row. Will in the front. Yes.
Hi, thank you so much, Ambassador. I wanted to ask about how you mentioned, how the role of the EU has shifted from a liberal to a post-liberal world, and some argue that the so-called Brussels effect has diminished in the sense of that as the EU is prioritizing economic security and industrial policy and strategic, strategic security in general, it is turning more inwards. And I wanted to ask if you agree with that, whether the Brussels effect is in fact diminishing, and if so, how does that affect third countries such as the UK? And I'm from Switzerland, so also in Switzerland, because in Switzerland right now it's becoming increasingly difficult for the government to justify domestically its alignment to the EU. So does that make it more difficult for third countries to align to the EU?
I mean, I trust that you know what the Brussels effect is. Or do you need a
tutorial?
Tutorial.
I don't know. It's something to do with moules frites.
It basically waffles in the underground. No, the Brussels effect is this idea that because of the market power of Europe, other countries have to adopt the standards of the European Union, right? It's famous. It's actually quite. Anyway, it makes my heart sing to have heard somebody mention the Brussels effect. In front, there's a blue Will right there. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Will. I'm a student in the International Relations Department. Thank you, Ambassador, for coming this evening. My question is, we've seen the US National Security Strategy appear to commit the US to progressively influencing Europe towards ideological alignment with the Trump administration. Do you believe European states should be doing more to stave off foreign influence in their politics, not just from Russia or China, but also the United States?
It's now a stated US policy to do that. This jacket right here.
Your Excellency, thank you so much for your presentation and views to share with us tonight. My name is Joachim von Hallers. I'm the chairman of Tuesday Club, a transdisciplinary think tank convening the smartest minds across London to explore geopolitically trending topics. Looking at the changing or evolving world order, would you frame it as such that soon there will be the countries which agree on the same values, still of the liberal order, who believe in the rule of law and multilateralism, and there will be a few countries who do not believe in this anymore? Do you think there will be the team players, such as Europe, for example, and the countries who are the odd ones out? If this is the correct framing, could you develop a scenario how this might play out, the team players and the odd ones out? Thank you.
All right.
I didn't get the question.
Team players versus spoilers, is that a realistic scenario?
In rebuilding
in rebuilding
multilateralism?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's see if I understood.
Brussels, essentially the exportation of EU regulations and EU standards.
Well, I mean, it's
I see.
The single market works on the basis of creating common standards. Otherwise, we could not operate. And of course, it has an impact beyond the European Union, which is also normal, and I think all our partners are very familiar with. Because we are a big market, actually the biggest trading partner for practically all the world. So we are conscious that this has other impacts. Of course, when we adopt standards, there are standards that are meant to reflect the most effective means of production and the best standards of production in terms of many of the conditions that exist, being greening the economy and environment concerns and human rights concerns and labor rights concerns. So we believe that these standards are really good for our societies, otherwise we would not adopt them. And we believe as well that most countries that are of the same, let's say, that share values with us, and definitely all those that belong to the same continent, would also share the same interest in pursuing these values and therefore the standards. While we're working in the EU, we always try to look at what we're trying to achieve internally, but we also try to always keep an eye on what the impact the measures that we take will have on the outside world. Most of the communications, if not all of the Commission, will have a chapter on the external impact of what we would call internal policies. So, you know, every country or group of countries, when they're legislating, when they're looking, they are looking first and foremost of what they're trying to achieve at national, or in our case, at EU level. And that is, I think, perfectly natural for any legislator. But we do try to bear in mind the impact it may have on others. And actually, for those that will have to follow those standards, we have mechanisms that foresee consultations so that we take into account also their views as we're developing our standards. And that's what we definitely have with Switzerland, and let's see what we end up with. But we have agreed, by the way, in the common understanding of the as an outcome of the summit of 25, that where the UK is admitted or invited to join single market elements, that there would be consultation processes also on standards related issues.
Use my devil's hat again?
What have I done wrong?
It's just to I know where this question is coming from, but I think that, you know, that the gist of it is the Brussels effect actually weakening, because I can see it that if we look across the globe, especially in a sort of a with an eye to Gaza, that the issue of double standards, of retrenching, friendshoring, is by definition weakening this Brussels effect. Do you see the tension there, or do you think
it's... Again, what's the meaning you're giving to the Brussels effect? Because I'm getting a bit lost.
No, the Brussels effect is this idea that, you know, Brussels decides something for the European Union, and that reverberates across the globe in terms of regulations, standards, but also norms and values, and creates a power of attraction.
Yeah.
So this is the theory.
Yes.
The practice, however, is that at times, you know, it doesn't work in such an automatic manner. And I wonder, you know, how do you see the practice? Because in the last couple of years, there have been moments of big tension beyond, you know, the EU borders. If I can, follow up on what was said.
Yeah, but I mean, it depends very much on the issue that you're dealing with, and what will that impact be. I mean, for example, on digital issues, we're looking at how to protect our own citizens in the digital sphere, and ensure that that they are aware of what they're seeing and reading, and the veracity of what is being published. So, but I don't see in which. At the end, it's for each country outside the European Union to decide what they wish to do. We have to regulate for our own citizens, which we do. We try to take into account as much as we can impacts that may happen for others. We try to limit as much as we can any unhelpful impacts, and engage with partners most of the time on these issues. So I don't see what the other issues that you mentioned, how they would interfere with that. Are we what is the capacity of our influence across the world? I hope that at least in standard setting, in good practices, that many of the measures that we're taking are taken into account in other parts of the world. Whether for other political reasons there may be more hesitation or not, it's for you to judge. I don't know. It's a matter of, depending through which lens you're looking at things. But the goal is to provide standards for our citizens, and bear in mind the impact it can have on others. Yes, we have to bear that in mind, and that was the aim of my answer. The capacity of influence that we have, again, I hope that we would have a strong capacity of influence, because I do think that most of the time we are doing what's right for our citizens, and I believe that what's right for EU citizens is probably right for citizens across the world, because we're all human beings and we are all enjoying and want to enjoy democratic rights, and so that is the spirit that animates EU law, and therefore the wider its influence, the better, I would say. But whether for other political reasons the influence is sometimes diminished or not, You know, that I leave that up to external observers to be the judge of that. But we have to do what we have to do also externally when required. There was
external
a question
interference
on external interference. That is a clear concern within the European Union. We have developed different mechanisms to look at this. We have a department that is screening information, that is publishing reports on foreign interference and manipulation of information and exposing situation where this is happening, and we're doing this across media and across continents. So we try to, as much as we can, shine a light on situations where there is foreign interference and manipulation of information, and we do that across the board.
And it doesn't matter who's doing the interfering.
I believe that I think that this is what we're doing. We're trying to protect ourselves against foreign interference. That is the policy. Now, on the last, I was also a bit at a loss. Team player versus
spoilers.
How to deal with spoilers outside or within the EU?
I mean,
there are no spoilers within the EU, of course. I think that we engage with partner countries. As all international actors try to take into account their concerns and interests, but we have to pursue our own interest as well, which is what we consistently try to do. But I don't know, maybe I'm not sure I understood your question fully, so I apologize for this. I was not hearing very well. It's my old age and poor.
It's also the acoustics in here are not fabulous.
But so I apologize that I'm not replying correctly to this question.
All right, we've got time for one more round of three, and I swear one of my students.
We have one of mine.
One of mine. Seven of mine.
Okay. Yeah.
Jewel.
Well, okay, Jewel.
Good evening, Excellency. I'm sorry, I'd like to go back to the question of Europe's phone number. For instance, after the 7th of October, whether you called von der Leyen or whether you called Josep Borrell, you had two different lines. So I guess the question of leadership in the EU is still at stake. And so what do you think, for instance, of Manfred Weber's proposition to merge the presidents of the European Council and the one of the Commission to have one voice to speak for the EU. Thank you.
Okay. Speaking with one voice, who was
Matthew,
it?
Matthew, on the right.
Right here, right in front of you.
Hello, thanks, Ambassador. My name is Matthew, I'm at the LSC. So if we're in the post-liberal world, are European values fundamentally liberal at heart? And if so, should we actively cultivate and promote them?
Ah, that's a good one. All right, I'm going to go to William at the back. He's got a jacket on. And
so,
Are
the values liberal at heart? That was a question.
Yeah, are European values liberal?
Okay, you'll have to define what liberal means for me. I had always looked at liberal more in economic terms, but okay.
Thank you very much. I'm William Weston, LSE, International Relations undergraduate. In a world where we are focusing more on security threats, is there a place for the EU in peacekeeping and development off the European continent?
Off of the European.
Peacekeeping outside the European.
Outside of Europe, yeah.
Okay. I'll start with this one, actually, in reverse order. Peacekeeping outside the EU, we've done it already. When we launched the European Security and Defence Policy, what's called now Common Security and Defence Policy, we created a crisis management capability, both on the military and on the civilian side. And we've launched a number of missions actually in Africa, in the Middle East, even in Aceh, in Indonesia. back in 2006, I think, And so we have been contributing. We contribute always to these efforts at the request of the interested country or parties, which is what we did in Indonesia at the time, or what we do in many African countries. Are they crisis management? I mean, are they peacekeeping operations? Not necessarily. There are very different types of mission. Very often there are missions aimed at strengthening doing security sector reform or strengthening the armed forces or monitoring type of missions, which was the case in Aceh particularly. So I can't remember the number of missions we have. We even have outside a mission, a very interesting mission, where the it's an operation actually, not a mission. It's a military operation that the UK was very much behind it, and actually a brilliant operation, Operation Atalanta, in the Indian Ocean to fight piracy, and that it's now become a maritime security operation. And so we have a number of these operations underway. These were thought for a time where we were thinking more in terms of crisis management than in terms strong deterrence, which is where we are right now. And that requires another set of tools, and that requires very strong development of defense capabilities. And that is exactly where we are now. But these operations are ongoing, and they are still very useful. Are the values that the EU and others within the Western world perhaps promote, defend liberal values? We could have a nice discussion on what liberal values are. I come from Spain. In my constitution, 1978 constitution, we say that Spain is a rule of law, a social rule of law state. So liberal in from where I come from, and we all come from different countries, you would have the social part missing. I would add the social element in terms of protection of citizens to the liberal values of just what is understood more as liberal values. I do think that within the EU we also have that social dimension that is very important in what we try to achieve. Of course, all the freedoms, fundamental freedoms, and respect for human rights and political freedoms, and I would add to that the social dimension, which I think is important. Plus, I would even add an international dimension of how we act outside. I think the European Union Treaty, the Treaty of the European Union, has one of the most comprehensive set of articles describing and actually trying to guide what are the main principles to act in foreign policy. And you have some constitutions that have that, but I think the EU, the treaty, and I'm not saying it's a constitution, there was a discussion about that many years ago, and it was decided as it is. We have a treaty, not a constitution. But it has what I would call a programmatic definition of the main principles and objectives that a foreign policy of the European Union should seek to achieve, and that's also part. And I would bring that in as well in the values that you were referring to, just not to limit to a more restrictive vision of liberal values, but maybe liberal values can be interpreted also more widely. At the end, we have name tags, and we all fill the blanks as depending on where we come from and what kind of education we've received very often, but and merging of the functions of the President of the European Council and the President of the Commission, they are huge tasks, both of them, and so of course it is at the end the wisdom of member states to decide whether they want to bring different functions together. I understand the logic of the division personally, but again, and first, if you ask me an EU position, there is no proposal right now on the table for this, and therefore we think that we have a functioning structure, and it should remain so. So that's official reply. If I think of it in a more academic way, from my own experience, the workload is huge on both, and the way you have to operate also can benefit from having two different actors and the play that they can bring. And I do not believe that this necessarily has to result in multiple different voices. It may result in multiple voices, but not necessarily different. There can be, and they are voices that reinforce themselves, and I think that's positive to the way we're currently functioning. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we've come to the end. I would very much like to thank the ambassador for being very generous in his replies to your questions. Thank you all for your questions. Thank you to Spiros and to Federica for acting as discussants. Please join me in thanking the ambassador and the discussants.
Thank you.
Thank you.